Hey, Nora.
Hey, Sandy.
Do you hear that? Do you hear that little kind of scratchy in the back of my throat?
Yeah, I totally. I feel like I'm even in the back of your throat as you speak.
Ew. I got COVID after Edmonton. Actually, I don't know like when exactly I got it, but yeah, it sucks.
That is so brutal. How many times? What number time is this?
This is my third time having COVID.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not testing positive anymore. It was much shorter than the first time I had it. It's, I was vaccinated this year, this season for it. So I'm like grateful for the preventative stuff that I've done to try to mitigate anything if I do catch it. But I did get it again. Sad face. But otherwise, I'm doing pretty good. I'm really happy about our Edmonton show. I really liked it.
Yeah. It was an amazing time. Lots of great feedback on the episode, too, from folks who weren't there. And we're back into looking for the next live show. So I know that there have been people in touch with us. What we really, really need is if you are a group that can help sponsor the event, that would be wonderful because that opens up a lot of options for us, like bringing in John Camille Farah to play or, you know, bigger venues or different kinds of venues. So if you think that you could sponsor maybe some of the costs for an event and you want us to come to your city, let us know. Maybe we can make it happen. We certainly would love to try.
Absolutely. So how was the rest of your week, Nora?
Oh, boy. Do you really want to hear this?
Oh, I mean, if you're going to introduce it like that, I do. Yeah.
Well. Okay, so I, as people will remember from the Edmonton Live show, and then I talked about it in my newsletter, I was at something called the Ottawa Book and Food Expo. And Sandy, what do you think about when you hear Ottawa Book and Food Expo?
I think about books and food.
That's what I thought, too.
And Ottawa.
Yep.
Those three things, primarily.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be those three things, too. Well, it turned out to be a little bit not that, to a maximum degree.
To a maximum degree? So it wasn't even in Ottawa?
In Ottawa. Okay, so, I was approached and months and months and months ago to do this, to MC panels at this book expo, and I was like, oh, that's awesome. And the icing on the cake was, and you're going to be with former Much Music VJ Bill Walichka. And, I always thought that Bill was a great interviewer, and I loved watching him on Much Music. I'm like that exact target demographic. So I was like, fuck, that sounds awesome. That sounds great. But I didn't actually see what the panels were or look really deeply into it. I met with the organizer on Skype and whatever. It seemed fine, disorganized, but like stuff is disorganized. And so I just put it out of my mind, like whatever. And then an article comes up from Press Progress's Luke Lebrun, and it goes through who a lot of the people are around it. And
who are the people around it?
Well, like there's some people that might not exist who were doing a lot of the outreach to people. There were sponsors that had said that they were never sponsoring it. Yeah.
What?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah. You get there, and as I say, I'm like,
oh my God, did you get scammed?
I mean, I'm hoping to still get my costs covered and be paid as we had agreed to it. And there's no indication that that's not going to happen. So I'm still in this like gray zone of hoping that things are going to work out fine. But
okay, jeez.
Yeah, but it was there was a kind of a community alert to say that it's going to be dangerous because it was convoy adjacent, and I think that was probably a not necessary thing to say. I mean, it wasn't dangerous at all. Like, there was day one.
It was convoy adjacent?
Well, yeah, because today, this is recording on Sunday, there was a panel that was all like convoy people or sympathetic to the convoy, a panel on freedom of speech. And I was supposed to co-moderate it. I didn't see the panel until Friday. Like, I didn't look. Because I was like, whatever.
Sounds like that may have been deliberate that they didn't share that with you.
Well, I mean, oh my God. I don't want to give them too much credit, but basically we were like, we're not doing this, Bill and I. And they were like, that's fine. And I think that there was, there's a level of political naivete in this because, like, from the people who were exhibitors, there was for sure a lot of new age spirituality stuff, a lot of groups that I would be very, very questionable of, different kinds of religions or you know, cults, frankly, like the Scientologists were there. But there was also a lot of mainstream religious folks, too. And there was some.
This sounds extremely bizarre. Like every sentence that you say, I'm like, what are you saying?
You're hearing me process what I've just gone through. Okay, there was a lot of really great cultural performances. So like the weekend started off with this really awesome guitar rocking indigenous singer. There was Brazilian dance. There was Southeast Asian music that was played by some young people. It was like, okay, interesting. This is cool. The sound guy and I became best friends. Like he was literally my highlight, because we got to connect on politics and we got to connect on how weird everything was. And, but you know, we started the event with this panel that, had, a reverend from the United Church, a progressive reverend from the United Church in Toronto, Adrian Harwood from CBC, who folks in Ottawa certainly know. And if you're ever late on Twitter at night, Adrian is the guy to follow because he shares the most wonderful music. And Kim Pate, the senator who does so much work on incarceration and fighting against injustices within the criminal justice system. These folks were on the panel, but so too was Maxime Bernier.
I mean, I remember you saying something about Maxime Bernier going to be on a panel, and I was very confused then, but now it's all coming together. I mean, the panel still seems to make no sense.
Yes.
Like, that construction of a panel makes no sense, but the platforming of Maxime Bernier, like, that's all making sense right now.
Yeah.
So did that panel happen?
Yes, the panel happened, and it was actually, I have to be honest, I am glad that I got to witness it. And it was very, very fascinating to see Bernier's tactics. So, you know, everyone in that conversation, and I should say there was another person as well who was from the Ottawa Youth Council. He was a young person, a conservative, but a young person. And everybody on the panel, except for Bernier, came in good faith with their ideas of how to make a just society in Canada. And the questions that we are asking them what is a just society, and what does security look like in a just society, and what's the role of profits in a just society? And Bernier is so, like, he's such an idiot and he's such a loudmouth that he's like hollering at the crowd lies, like just lying, like, well, inflation's caused by, you know, government money being thrown into the economy. And it's like, no, we know that inflation is driven by profits. And he's like, what the hell are you talking about? That's a lie. And it's like, it's not a lie. Now, what was interesting is in the crowd, you know, there were certainly Bernier supporters, but I would say maybe only five out of a few dozen people.
So he was trying to broaden his base or what?
No, I don't think so. I think he's just doing his performance, but people were not there to see him necessarily, which was refreshing, which meant that we could actually kind of have a bit of a debate. And so, I mean, I'm moderating, so I didn't get to do the debating, but Adrian was excellent, really challenged Bernier on his lies, really, interjected and tried to bring the conversation back into a place where everyone else was. Senator Kim Pate was wonderful.
All right, Adrian.
Yeah. And then at the end, Bill's taking audience questions, and the questions range from very bad questions to very good questions. And, we're like, okay, thank you very much. We're done. And someone grabs his microphone and starts like trying to give the senator a COVID is fake book. And so I kind of get into the middle of this, and Bernier grabs me by the shoulders and tries to physically remove me from the sight lines where they're trying to film this little melee.
Oh my God. How did that interaction end? What?
Adrian was in there and he's like, did you just touch her? Oh my God. What is wrong with you? Like, it was really, it was really intense. And I, you know, I was there to do a job and try to keep the peace and certainly shut down this ridiculous rant that was happening at the microphones. I'm talking to the sound people and that was all fine. And then she's yelling at me for stopping her freedom of speech. And I was like, lady, we called for questions. You did not put up your hand. Go to hell. And it ended. I mean, Bernier comes up and apologizes to me, which was so weird. And you just see the desire to physically control things that is just at the surface of that man. And that really explains a lot of how he approaches, like, political discourse and how he doesn't care that he's lying. He's just going to blow through certain questions and blow through certain topics because he's Maxime Bernier. So it was pretty weird. It was pretty weird.
Oh, God. That is, very... very odd, and I hope that's the last we have to talk about Maxime Bernier forever.
Yeah. I mean, the rest of the day was not great, and as the day is going on, you know, Bill and I are like, this is weird. And then, of course, this morning happens, and this is the panel of the Freedom Convoy people, and it was just like, peace, everybody. Peace. So I didn't have to do that work. And instead, I agreed to do interviews with the food kiosks, which was wonderful because they were all like small caterers or small restaurants that were just trying to get the people of Ottawa to find out about their food. And unfortunately, we all kind of didn't get the truth of what was actually going to be going on. And I'm not really sure, honestly, that the organizer really understood what was going on either. So we were all in this very memorable moment. So, dear listener, if you're wondering how in the fuck did Nora get herself into this, the answer is I don't like saying no to stuff. And I guess I was duped. Someone asked if I was duped. I was like, oh, how dare you? I'm undupable. And I was like, no, I'm fucking duped.
Yeah, you were totally fucking duped. You were duped. But you know what? It sounds like a lot of people were duped. So, I mean, at least you're in good company. Oh, yeah. Well, good and bad company. You're in odd company is what you are. Well, shit. I'm glad you're not there anymore and that you weren't, like, assaulted any more than you were from Maxime Bernier.
Well, Randy Hillier did embrace me, and I was like, I wanted to die. So there was, the whole, folks, I took a lot of grief this weekend. If you are unhappy to see my name there, I was dying inside all weekend. But you know what?
I mean, look, we had such a great time in Edmonton. Perhaps the world just needed to, like, you know, get right back on balance and give you some really terrible experiences.
Yeah. And I want to just give a shout out to Bill Walichka. So if you know who Bill is and you watched him on Much Music and Much More Music, I mean, he is a sweetheart. I had such a blast with him. And the poor guy was trying to sell his new book, which is just memoirs of interviewing the biggest stars in the world. And he was like, I don't know if I'm going to sell a single book at this fucking thing. So shout out to Bill for being just a really great, duo for this terrible weekend. Okay, I'm done. That's it.
I mean, look, if you're going to try to scam people, I don't know about Ottawa, but saying books and food sounds like a pretty good way to scam people. So, yeah. I mean, at least their strategy was on point. You know what might write this for you, though? A little bit of gratitude. Do we have some folks to thank?
We have some folks to thank. And of course, we didn't get to do the gratitude piece last week. So thank you so much to everyone in the last 2 weeks who have donated or supported us or shared the podcast or just sent encouraging words or, Nora, what the fuck? Why the fuck are you hanging out with Maxime Bernier? Right. That's cool. You can ask me that question. Thanks especially to Dave, Jules, Just Nigel, Aaron, Janet, Caitlin, Clara, John, Zara, and Janetta.
Hey, thanks, folks, so much. Nora, we have a lot to talk about this week. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of things happened this week that we should talk about. I don't even know where to start. But so why don't I start with some feelings? I have some feelings to discuss with you. I'm sad.
Oh, what?
Yeah, for all kinds of reasons, but focused for this conversation, I am sad. I'm watching the uprisings in the United States on college campuses, and it's pretty amazing to see how many students are just like, no, fuck it, you know, like, no more. We are not going to be a part of funding a genocide and are taking their administrations to task and are doing what they can, facing off with some pretty fucking draconian repressive tactics from on-campus cops and off-campus cops alike. It is just incredible to watch this uprising. And I'm sad because, I mean, we've talked before about the decimation of the Canadian student movement, but nothing is more like of a confirmation of that for me than that there hasn't been anything similar happening in Canada. I feel like had this happened 15, 20 years ago, there would be no question that there would be campuses across Canada that would be acting in solidarity and taking similar actions. And, you know, maybe I just haven't given them enough time, but I'm just like, maybe by the time we publish this, something will be happening. I don't know. But I'm looking at it.
Something is happening. One thing to note is happening.
Tell me more.
And with the time change, you may have missed it. Okay, so Sandy, this is a protest that happened not primarily at Ivy League schools, but including especially Ivy League schools in the United States. So who in Canada would be the school that would be the first to have an encampment?
McGill.
The Harvard of the North. Yes. Yeah. Yes. They have just today set up an encampment at McGill. And it's not small.
Oh, my God.
Small.
What?
Yes. Yeah, the Canadian press is reporting. Mm-hmm, you literally would have just missed it. I saw it today only because I was doing nothing but looking at my phone, making sense of the world. And they have set up a camp, an encampment. And really, McGill has been doing a lot of the best activism, a lot of the most visible activism related to Gaza. So it isn't too surprising that it's happened at McGill first, but it is there.
Okay, but yeah, but Nora, I don't know if I can count McGill as the Canadian student movement as part of the Canadian student movement.
Ooh, touche.
I'm sorry, but it's Quebec. It's different in Quebec, and so as you know, and so I'm still sad. I'm still sad. I'm like, yeah, I'm sad about what it means for how long. Big P politics in Canada did their darndest, the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party, to try to decimate the student movement, and how successful they were. It means that there hasn't been, there's not a lot of mentorship going on from people who were there before. It means that maybe folks are too frightened because they don't have anybody to tell them what to do. How to do it and how to keep it as safe as possible and to share learnings from when things like that have happened in the past. I don't know. It's distressing. So, all that's to say, like, you know, Nora and I have said this before, but you know, if you're trying to figure something out, let us know, because if you need some help, we'd be happy to help you. But it's just, the consequence of the decimation of the Canadian student movement is just making me real sad this week.
Yeah, I've been reflecting on this too, and I've been wondering, because it's not as if the American student movement's in much better shape. In fact, it's been differently and more colossally decimated for longer than in Canada. And I was like, is it the proximity of the United States to Israel that has made this a bigger issue on campus there than here? Is it the memory of Vietnam and Kent State and organizing that happened in 68 and 69 against the war that triggered students and faculty to do similar kinds of actions today? Like, I don't know if there's a material difference in the United States than in Canada that has created the conditions for these things to happen in the United States. But certainly, you know, activism around Palestine on Canadian campuses is deep. It goes back decades. I see a lot of campus activists who I knew who were involved in like SPHR, which was Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, way back in the day, who are still really involved in leading a lot of Palestinian solidarity initiatives all across Canada. And you're right that it has been. I've also been wondering where is this? When is this? When does this happen? What is going on? And knowing the radical actions that students have been taking in Montreal, you know, I'll include Concordia as well. It is wonderful to see this at McGill. And considering we are recording this on Sunday, by Tuesday, I don't know, I imagine there will be another tent city somewhere in the country. I certainly hope so. But then you get folks like Anthony Housefather, who's, of course, a Montreal-based MP, saying this on Twitter. I call on the McGill administration in public, as I have in private, to make sure this encampment is removed according to their own rules, given that we need to make sure students feel safe accessing campus for their final exams that are coming up. Though I don't imagine there's too many final exams coming up in May.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow.
Like, buddy, are you on campus? Like, obviously not.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, that's, I'm really pleased to see that something's happening at McGill. And you know what? I think that the conditions that are different in this, the United States, just having spent a little bit of time here, I think what the major difference is, why something like this can spread in the United States, even though there is no really great student movement here, is that there are a lot more sophisticated movements at all, just at all. And so as a young person in the United States, you can be trained to be an activist in so many different ways, so many different places. There's like a whole bunch of different pathways to learning about community organizing and activism. In Canada, there are very few. And the Canadian student movement was a very, very important one. So there's that. The other thing that I you know, that it is obvious, but we should just think about when we're seeing all of the repression happening on campus right now, is like, remember how fucking for the last, I don't know, 15 years, we were talking about how free speech on campus, we were having all these discussions about free speech on campus led by the right that were just like, oh my God, free speech doesn't exist on campus because, I don't know, right wing, tiny Tory type folks felt like every time they said something that people were like upset at them, made them sad. Well, this is a real free speech issue on campus. People talking about a genocide happening in the world and literally being beaten up by police, being suspended, having their access to campus removed. Like that's a free speech issue. And oddly, all of that concern seems to be absent in this conversation. Go figure.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because this panel, like I sat through the panel this morning and listened to it. I didn't listen to all of it because it was boring and not great. But here you had three right-wing free speech activists on a panel about free speech. And obviously, Palestine didn't even get the briefest of mentions from what I heard. Which is interesting, because I don't know if these people are Zionists. I kind of doubt that all three of them are Zionists. Maybe they are. I don't know. But it is true that the mainstream media takes its cues from how the far right talks about freedom of speech while actively suppressing the speech of those of us on the left. And there's just no mainstream place for us to have this conversation, because it is so dominated by voices within media that take their lead from the far right. And it is dangerous, to say the least. And instead, what we get are, ridiculous pearl clutching around people chanting "Viva, Viva Intifada!" Like "Long live the uprising!" What the fuck, you know? Or God, at this point, Israel's killed 40,000 people. Maybe there's going to be some people that say maybe Israel should fucking not exist. I mean, that's not an unreasonable reaction to a genocide. It's not a reaction I hold. It's not something that I agree with. I don't have to agree with it, but this is what dominates the narrative of what is speech, what's allowable and acceptable speech right now. And at the same time, we got the CAFEA ban in the Ontario Legislative Assembly. And I mean, you know, it centers around the one person, Sarah Jama, who's been wearing a CAFEA. Where's the NDP? Why isn't a single NDP member who apparently supports Palestine worn a CAFEA?
Yeah, I mean, Merritt seems to have signaled that something like that will be happening this week with the video address that she put out giving Doug Ford a deadline to allow the CAFEA to be worn, or the NDP would be doing something. It's like, I feel like that is likely what they're going to do. But I mean, you're absolutely right. Where is the NDP? I mean, the image of the speaker talking to Sarah Jama, like that's, if you haven't seen that image, it was an image that went around this week when the speaker was telling Sarah Jama to leave the legislature and she refused. And I mean, it's such a, it's just, I can't describe it well enough. Like, you just got to take a look at it. It's really clear what the power dynamics are in that photo and what's going on. And it's just so reprehensible. And it's like, oh my God, you know, every time the free speech issue would come up in the last 15, 20 years, it would just be so frustrating to try to make clear to people, like, you folks, like, the issue of free speech is about state forces refusing to allow people their freedoms. And here it is, okay? State forces. Nowhere more clear than, like, the police or any legislature, Ontario or otherwise, making these sorts of moves. And, gosh, it's... this is where we're at. This is where we're at. And speaking of Ontario being really shitty, Ontario and BC continue to be really shitty this week by announcing some late Friday shitty shit. Mm. Who do you want to hear about first?
Let's stick with Ontario.
Let's start there.
Yeah,
because we're there.
Yeah.
So Stephen Lecce announces, like, major changes to education policy, including, like, how things are going to be funded, which from what I can tell, not we still don't have, like, a real sort of response from any advocacy group really spelling out exactly what's been done, because it's so complicated. It's like apparently a wholesale change as to some of the funding realities, but also embedded in there are some new rules that are going to take place if Stephen Lecce gets his way, which include, like, a ban on mobile phones in the classroom.
Sure, that'll work.
Just, like, what? A ban on mobile phones in the classroom? Like, you're going to make teachers police now? And, like, when a phone breaks or gets lost, like, what's going to happen there? Like, what? That's just not going to work. It's just outrageous, and it's not going to work. And it's weird. It's weird. It can only be bad, given that it was released late on a Friday. So there you go, Ontario.
I mean, you know, this whole cell phone thing, it's a perennial issue, and there are structural issues related to whether or not kids are on, let's say, screens too much. There are structural issues related to that, and certainly the internet is changing the way children learn. Kids are coming to the classroom with, like, a lot of, like, specific knowledge that kids wouldn't have had necessarily years ago, like, you know, really young kids knowing a lot about, like, how the pyramids were built, or, you know, like, different empires that they learned about on YouTube. And that, I'm not saying any of that's negative. It's just an interesting kind of thing that the internet has brought into education, that you have kids who are really uneven in what they know about the world because of the different levels of internet interaction that they have. And this is one of the reasons, I think, that there was a lawsuit being launched against the major media companies, social media companies, by the Ontario Teachers Unions, I think. But, you know, at the end of the day, anything that makes a teacher more of a cop is a bad idea, because the teachers who aren't cops will be like, this is stupid, I'm not enforcing this. And then the teachers who are failed cops or wannabe cops, they're going to make students' lives miserable with this. They'll confiscate phones. Phones will get lost. They'll get stolen. There'll be lawsuits. They'll be, you know, used for cracking down on students in a racist way, in a classist way. Like, you know, we know. The same thing happens with hats, right? And then, so imagine you got a hat that's a freaking cell phone. And frankly, you know, who's texting kids the most during the day when they're at school? It's their parents. It's their parents. So who are you pleasing here? Because it's the parents that text kids in the day. It's not their friends. They're all in class together. It's silly, and it's performative politics, hoping that people will ignore that there are really huge problems actually in the school system that the Conservatives absolutely will not try to fix.
And really huge problems in the province. I mean, yep. Another bad thing that Ontario did this week, along with, you know, the federal government, was this $5 billion just going straight over to Honda. Did you see that? Well, I know you reported on it.
Did you see how much the money is per job?
Oh, do the math for me, Nora. Tell me. It's 1,000 jobs.
It's amazing.
So it's hilarious, actually.
Yeah. It's $5 million per job.
Oh my God, they're going to be paid so well.
Like, you might as well give $5 million to 1,000 random Ontarians and literally just track them for the rest of their lives to see what they do with it, under the condition that they do something interesting with it.
I mean,
that would be cool.
It would probably be really great for the economy.
Yeah, fuck. Can you imagine? There'd be like really interesting new industries that were all created by these people who are like, yes, finally I can make my invention to pick up leaves very quickly.
Wow. But yeah, that's a pretty, like, what in the fuck is going on with that shit? Ugh. God, it just makes me sick.
Well, it's the natural location of where we are with capitalism. And you know, this is not the first enormous investment in an EV battery initiative, right? There's already been $15 billion promised to Volkswagen, and then another $10 to $15 billion promised to Stellantis. And it's capitalism. It's the natural result of what happens to capitalism, where they're so powerful that governments are actually just paying them to operate here, paying them to give us the privilege of $5 million per job. Now, this is where I'm actually very concerned, though, about how we articulate these things on the left, because oftentimes, you know, like the unions, Honda's not a union factory, so I haven't heard Unifor say anything about this. But in the past, Unifor and a lot of union folks have been very positive on these announcements because, of course, they'll create union jobs, blah, blah, blah. But we have to be very critical of this, right? Like, one of the things that were said today in this fucking far right freedom of speech panel by Randy Hillier was, someone asked in the audience, okay, so, you know, you keep blaming the government, but it seems to me that the corporations are also just as bad. So who's affecting us the most here? Is it government? Is it corporations? Is it both? And Hillier, who sat in the legislature as a progressive conservative in Ontario, and who's nuts, and who's far right, and who's got this far right fucking movement behind him, his answer, I was like, oh, wow, things are confusing in this moment in time right now. His answer was, honest to God, when you have corporations and government operating together in lockstep, if this was the 1930s, we would call that fascism. And I'm like, oh, I didn't expect to hear that from the fucking guy who's closer to being a fascist than anyone else.
Yeah, like,
around these days.
That's surprising.
And he says... Isn't it interesting? And he says, and so it's not fascism today. Today we call it P3s, public-private partnerships.
He what? Does he know what party he's in? Is he aware?
I know. And this for me was like the moment where it's like, okay, so the grievances that average people have, regardless of their political orientation, are caused by capitalism. And it's not just capitalism, but it's the capitalist democracy that we have in the West, right? And the way that these two things come together. And if the far right, the real far extreme right, is explaining the combination of corporate and government rule as fascism, and it's an accurate thing to say, we have to be really way better and way more accessible with our message to make people understand the, and therefore the solution is this and not that.
Ooh, yeah, no kidding. All right, you ready for BC?
I'm always ready for British Columbia, man.
And you remember who's in power in British Columbia?
It's the Progressive Conservatives, right?
No. Wrong. Incorrect.
The orange progressive conservatives?
Yes, exactly. The NDP is in power in British Columbia, and late Friday they announced where to start? I wanted to make a reference to our live show, but I believe the part of our live show where we talked about this is actually in the question and answer. So you will hear that at some point later, dear listener. But if you were at the live show, we did reference at one point that in terms of drug policy in Canada, that we should be watching very closely what was happening in the United States, because people had started making noise about walking back pilot programs that have decriminalized drugs in places like Oregon, and that we could probably expect that something similar would happen in Canada. And Nora, what was announced on Friday is that the BC government is wanting to recriminalize drugs and is moving towards recriminalizing drugs and is asking Health Canada also to end the exemptions that were put in place in, I believe, 2021 so that people would stop being criminalized for drugs. Because all the data we know and have spoken about before shows that that criminalization does not stop people from dying from drug poisoning. And here we are. The NDP government in BC, for the last few months, there's been a little bit of a concerted effort similar to what's happening in the U.S. I'm sure that these are things are related. Concerted effort in conservative newspapers and media outlets to criticize the decriminalization programs and plans in Vancouver and in BC, and to say that they are not working. And so there's been quite a bit of this, these media reports, and the NDP is caving to them, and they are doing the absolute wrong thing.
I struggle to imagine what the NDP would look like if it was a total CSIS op. If this is what the NDP looks like. When apparently it's not, but maybe it is. I mean, it's actually incredible how much you predicted that one that you will hear in a future episode. And I think that the way you explained it is just so helpful, right? That these programs are not in place for long enough to have a very clear, this is working. Though, I mean, you know, lives are being saved in British Columbia. Like, just look at the data compared to how out of control death rates are in Alberta right next door, right? Like, there are things that you can point to say that this is working. And so if you look at what David Eby's justification for this is, he said in a press release, quote, keeping people safe is our highest priority. I mean, he sounds like Air Canada. And you know, like, buddy, you're not Air Canada. Okay. While we are caring and compassionate for those struggling with addiction, we do not accept street disorder that makes communities feel unsafe.
What's the real problem here, Nora? Is it safety or is it feelings?
Well, I would say that it's probably feelings, because it goes on, you know, in a bit of paragraphs and says this change would not recriminalize drug possession in a private residence or a place where someone is legally sheltering or at overdose prevention sites and drug checking locations. So it's like, so you can be, so it's not the drugs are unsafe, because you can still do tons of drugs in your home if you have a home. Oh, you don't have a home? Oh, then you've got to find a home if you want to do drugs legally. Because people feel unsafe when they walk by and see people using drugs.
It's just so despicable. It's like, I mean, the way that they talk about this too is, it's like, you know, we've given it a shot and it's not working. It's like, y'all gave the war on drugs decades of a shot. Decades. And and your solution here to something being tried for a couple of years and not seeing what immediate results that you thought were going to happen, which is outrageous. Your response here to, come on, let's be clear. It's pressure from the right is to say, let's give it back to the war on drugs. Let's just go back to what we had before, which was obviously not working then either. Like, how is this the way that you want to move? It's like, obviously these people and their lives do not matter to you. Otherwise you wouldn't be making them more unsafe by making them again a target for police.
No, absolutely. And it just, I think, probably uncomplicates these massive street sweeps. Right. Where it's like, the under the auspices of illegal drug use, you can just sweep everyone out, because otherwise people are allowed to gather in a park. They're allowed to sit together on a curb. They're allowed to just hang out. And so what is the auspices under which you are operating to sweep people out of an area of, you know, a public street? And having seen that in Edmonton last week, it's very clear that the second you have that, like, you know, reason to do it, then the police are just happy to do it. And then there's no questions asked. You must leave or we arrest you. And so, you know, this idea of feeling safe is just so enraging and statistically, like, just not true. Like, who is unsafe in the situation between someone who's using street drugs who may not have access to testing them, let's say, and the person who has a salary of $80,000 and a home and is walking by at the moment that that person's using drugs? Who's unsafe in that situation? It's obvious. It's obvious. It's not the person who's like, oh my God. It's the person who might not be able to test their drugs and see what they're using is going to kill them or not. You know, and God, like, I mean, I obviously have no, like, I've lost all of my vestiges of caring about the NDP at all, but it's just like, why do you exist, NDP? Why? Just call yourself the Liberal Party and make it easier, or just get rid of the NDP, like, merge finally. I mean, this is actually very interesting, and this is, I think, something we'll have to talk about in future weeks, this push of people to try and get the two parties to be much closer together as they stare down polyever. I know that there's people within the labor movement that are interested in talking of even a pact, maybe, between the two parties for the election. And, Oh, yeah. And it's like, why even exist? Why, like, or is this literally just a job creation program for the fucking most mediocre labor bureaucrats and fucking shitty student union activists and fucking hack NGO leaders? Like, is that what the NDP is? Because that's what it looks like.
Man, I want to read a little bit more from the CBC news story that announced that was part of this announcement, which is just basically reads like a government announcement. So good job there, CBC. And then I want to read from another report.
Hey, Sandy, it's Friday night. What do you expect? That they work?
Yeah, actually, that is exactly what I expect. In that's what I expect from any news organization. Not that that's exactly what I expect from Canadian media. But there are a couple more things that I want to point out from this article. And then I want to point to a totally different article from the TAI, which is like actual reporting. So one of the things that I think is like really interesting in the way that the premier of BC talks about this is that he says, we're taking action to make sure police have the tools they need to ensure safe and comfortable communities for everyone, blah, blah, blah. When police are called to a scene where illegal and dangerous drug use is taking place, they will have the ability to compel the person to leave. To compel the person to leave. What does that mean, Nora? What does the police have the ability to compel the person to leave mean?
I don't leave or I'll arrest you. Get the fuck out of here. Here's a big giant hook.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, why are we talking about this using words that like don't really describe what's happening? And then the other thing is that they that this report references is that they don't talk to any drug users in this report at all, which, I mean, it seems as though maybe you might want to talk to some drug users or at least some drug advocates of drug users, but they do talk to the police.
Wait, and the police are using drugs too, so maybe they're shooting two birds with one stone.
Oh, perhaps. It says, Vancouver Police Deputy Chief Fiona Wilson said, we've heard loud and clear from the frontline police officers who continue to see the unintended ramifications that unchecked public drug use has on the safety and well-being of neighborhoods. And the feedback has been unequivocal. Public consumption is a significant issue that needs to be addressed and major changes are required. The police are saying that, so guess we'll give this job back to the police. What the fuck?
Mm. I bet that they need a couple million dollars for that, too.
Oh, my God. Of course. It's just so abhorrent. The reporting that I want to reference from the TAI, though, is some reporting that's been happening over the months about the impact of a compassion club named the Drug User Liberation Front. And now
DELF,
that compassion,
yes,
DELF, yes, exactly. And so that compassion club, if you're not familiar with the term, essentially what they do is they buy street drugs and then they subject them to rigorous testing, or they buy drugs from other sources, and they subject them to rigorous testing. And then they sell them back at cost to drug users who are looking to make sure that they have access to a safe supply of drugs, rather than making themselves unsafe by just going to what's available on the street, and they don't know if it could be mixed with something else and could result in some poisoning, fatal or not. And so Dulf had been doing that work for some time until, guess what happened, Nora?
Oh, I know the story, so I'll let you do the reveal there.
Okay, so this is based on reporting from Michelle Gamage. Not sure if I pronounced that right. It could be Gamage, but Michelle Gamage or Gamage of the Taiyi, who's been reporting on Dulf and what's happened. The police did a raid of the founders of Dulf's home and work. And they did not charge them with anything, but as a condition of their release from their arrest, they're not able to interact with one another or go to the Compassion Club, which basically means that that Compassion Club no longer exists. And that has caused, of course, so many people who relied on that service to then turn elsewhere for their drugs. And in one report that Michelle made, she talks to one of the clients of Dulf who ended up turning to street fentanyl for the first time because they did not have access to the clean heroin that they would have been able to get from Dulf, which is like, we're going backwards in terms of trying to keep people safe. Like, nobody is being kept safe from this. And part of the reason I'm turning to this now, that report was made in November, I think it was November or October of 2023. Part of why I'm talking about this now is because more recently, a report has come out, a research report on the impact of Dulf. And the report was super positive. The research report was super positive and talked about how many lives they saved, something the police can never claim to have done.
No. And I mean, we can bring this back to the first topic of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of association. Like, how in the fuck can they stop someone from associating with people under no conditions of arrest? You know, like, it's really enraging. And if you know anyone that uses hard drugs, that uses hard street drugs, buying them from sketchy sources, you know, the biggest fear, the scariest part of it is you don't know if they're using drugs that are clean. And to take that away from people, to take people's right away from self-organizing, to make sure that the drugs that they're using are clean, and to not give them any options, you know, like at all that work, it's unjustifiable. It's completely unjust. And people are going to die as a result of this. So David Eby, the BCNDP, everybody that supports that entire apparatus, this is fucked. And I literally don't give a rat's ass any other initiative that you've done that's like awesome and so great about the BCNDP. You're so wicked. It's like, no, this is your fucking caving to cops at the expense of people's lives. And why? Like, it's so undefensible.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's anything left to say. This week's news is just full of indefensible crap. And, you know, again, I'm like looking at what's happening in the United States, and at the same time as it makes me sad, it also makes me quite hopeful. I hope it does inspire more organizing the world over, and certainly in Canada, because it is incredibly inspiring to see the way that students, continuing the great tradition of students being among some of the most powerful unifying forces to like force our societies to take a look at what they're doing. And I really do hope that what's happening at McGill does spread to the rest of Canada and throughout Quebec because fuck, like, let's go. It's time. It's way past time.
And postscript, you know how I said that Concordia has also had some action. McGill and Concordia, showing the way.
Oh, great. McGill and Concordia. Not much has changed then, I say.